I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Russian-made tanks pounding the city of Homs in Syria for a fourth straight day as Russia's foreign minister was given a hero's welcome over in the capital, Damascus. Russia, a close ally, says Syrian President Assad is ready for dialogue with opposition groups, which have been under increasing attack from government troops since Russia and China vetoed a UN resolution to condemn the Syrian crackdown. This standoff has lasted 11 months. What's endgame? Coming up, we'll speak to Edward Lucas of The Economist about Syria and other foreign policy challenges. But first, we've reached Danny Abdul Dayem on Skype. He's a Syrian who's lived in London and is now in Homs, the area that has most protested the Syrian government and is now most under attack. Danny, hello.
Hello.
What's happening where you are now?
Shelling. They haven't stopped from 5 a.m. in the morning. They will stop at 7 p.m. See, that's their normal time. They bombard us from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. That's how we live now.
Yeah.
You can stay between 5 a.m., then you get bombarded after that. So you have to get inside your room, get safe, get your children out of the windows.
What am I hearing in the background? Is that other people talking, or do you have news reports? Do you have news from outside of the city?
I have more than 20 people sitting in this house with me, more than 20 sitting in the house with me, reporters, journalists from out the world, because everyone's just sitting in houses here. You can't stay in the second floor or the third floor. There's a place next to where I'm sitting now. This area I'm sitting in is called Baba Amr. You can't cross the street without running. You can't from the snipers. You get shot by a sniper. This isn't a normal life. This is not a normal life. Kids from 8 years old, 9 years old, they know that they have to run now. That isn't a life. A kid has to run to cross the street so he doesn't get shot by a sniper.
Well, what does that mean for food, medical supplies?
We've been shut down for 4 days. Before these 4 days, we had like five or six days that the army wasn't hitting that strong. They were a bit afraid from the Arab League decision, and we had the monitors here. So when the monitors were here, the Arab monitors, the government wasn't hitting that strong. After the monitors left, they got the army back in, they got the tanks back in. They did a big massacre 3 days ago in an area called Khaldi. That was before the UN gave that decision, a day before. They killed over 300 people in that area in Khaldi by bombarding. After the UN gave that decision and abandoned the Syrian people, it was like giving the Syrian regime the green light, and they're okay, that it can kill more. The Assad army hit us for the first time with rocket launches.
So you're saying that you feel that after China and Russia vetoed the UN decision to intercede, that that gave Syria the green light to bombard you. And you're in the area, the Baba Amr district in Homs, which is said to be rebel-held, and that's why tanks are said to be closing in on it. Are you a rebel? Is that how you'd categorize yourself?
Can I? What do you mean by rebel? I don't like the word a rebel.
Yeah.
Anyone who says I want freedom, is the Syrian government says he's a terrorist, or he's from Al Qaeda, or he's a spy from America, or he's an Australian spy. I'm a Syrian, a British person came back to get the news out in English. The government got it on the Syrian TV that I am Mossad. I'm an Australian spy. Just because I'm asking for freedom, just because I'm trying to help my people. These aren't rebels. This isn't how we are. This isn't how the Syrian people are. I ask anyone who's been in Syria, this Syria is a civilized place. People are really nice here, and they're being killed for asking for freedom. And where's the humanity in the world? No one is doing anything about this.
Danny, do you worry, given that the government has targeted you in particular and said that, you're, as you said, an Israeli agent from Mossad or an Al-Qaeda agent, the two aren't compatible, but, given that, are you worried? Are you a targeted man if these troops get to where you are?
Yes, I've been targeted 4 months ago when I went to England. See, I got shot 4 months ago. The bullet came in my back. I went to England, got the news out in England on the CNN, on the BBC and on Sky News. So I was wanted from then. Mm. I didn't come back in the country by the airport. I was smuggled back in, because if I went in by the airport, they would catch me and I would be tortured to death.
What's being said is that you and others in the Homs area didn't want to negotiate because you wanted nothing short of the fall of the Assad regime. Do you think that's a mistake?
Yes,
is it a mistake not to do some negotiating in what?
No. We do not want to negotiate with the regime. We're not going to negotiate over, believe me, there's over 50,000 people dead. I know they're saying 6,000, 7,000, but even me as a Syrian, I don't know how much there's dead. We have mass graves everywhere. We've got bodies missing, people missing. We don't know how many people are dead in prison. We do not want to negotiate. We want this regime to fall. And then people say that the poor people go out in this revolution. I'm not poor. I was in England. I went to England. I could have stayed there, couldn't I? I came back. This revolution is for everybody. This revolution isn't only for poor people.
What would you like to see now, Danny? You know that leaders here in the U.S. have asked for people who feel the same way about the Assad regime, leaders of Turkey, for instance, to form an alliance, to bring support from outside the country. Is that enough for you, or do you want Western and other allies to come into Syria? What would you like to see?
We would like all the armies of the world to come in and occupy Syria. We don't care.
Even if that might be
we
a bloodbath.
Can you see what's going on now? The problem is the world isn't understanding. All those videos you're seeing on YouTube, I don't know if anyone's seen them, of pieces of bodies in the street, there's already a bloodbath going on. They are taking the women. 15 officers raped one woman in one day. Some of them come back alive, and some of them, they torture them to death after that. What do you think that is?
Well, how are you doing for food? How are you doing for other supplies?
Okay, right now they've shut the whole area down. Yesterday they shot three ambulances, the Red Crescent, if you know the Red Crescent ambulance.
Sure.
They tried to get medication in, and they shot at them, but none of them got injured. Civilian cars try to get doctors in, they get shot at. No one can leave, no one can get in. We don't have that much medication, doctors, nurses. We can't do any more operations.
Yeah.
Yesterday, we couldn't stitch up most of the patients. We took our shirts off. We just wrapped their hands off with our shirts. We couldn't stitch them up. Half of the injured people died, and it wasn't fatal injuries.
This is after the hospital area was shelled. Danny Abduldayem in Homs in Syria, thank you so much for speaking with us, and take care.
Thank you.
Again, Danny Abduldayem on Skype from Homs. He's a Syrian who's lived in London and now in the Homs area, the one that's been most protesting the Syrian government and is now most under attack. Let's bring in Edward Lucas, international editor for The Economist, also former Moscow bureau chief for that magazine. He's in the Economist studios in London. Edward, as we said at the start today, the Russian foreign minister said President Assad is open to dialogue with dissidents like Danny. And we just heard Danny say, no, they don't want to negotiate. Your thoughts?
I'm very sceptical of the idea that the Assad regime is suddenly, literally, the road to Damascus, a conversion on the road to Damascus. I think the way in which they make decisions is very paranoid and introverted, and they feel that the only way out for them is either victory, in which they crush the opposition the way they've crushed uprisings in the past, or it's death, where they end up like Gaddafi, really shot in a drain in a ditch somewhere. And I think there's a chance of trying to broker some kind of dignified withdrawal, but I think it's a fairly small one, and I'm rather sceptical that Russia's in a position to do it.
Yeah. Well, and we're hearing BBC reports that Russia is, in fact, also gently nudging its ally Syria to consider reforms. But I just, the human aspect for a second, because it's always so good, you know, here we're hearing somebody hunkered down in their home, in Homs. It's hard to imagine what will happen to Danny and others if Homs falls to government troops.
Well, they'll all be killed and the city will be flattened. And this is what this regime did it. Bashar Assad's father, Assad Sr., did that with Hama. And the reports are between 20,000 killed, maybe more. So this regime has an extraordinary capacity for violence, which it's displayed in the past. And I think it's absolutely listening to that account, particularly when you think that the world is in a position to do something. This is a terribly unfair fight. They have rifles and maybe Molotov cocktails to fight against tanks and heavy artillery. And I suspect that there probably are some weapons making their way via Turkey, perhaps thanks to Qatari sponsorship, but there's certainly room to do more. And I think the other very important psychological front is to try and make the regime see how isolated it is. And it's very good news that some Arab countries have been closing the Syrian embassy, expelling the Syrian diplomats, and giving the regime a feeling that that the ground's shifting away from it. And I think the more of that happens, the better, actually, because it will increase the leverage that might possibly lead to a negotiated solution.
Well, and today we heard the Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, also joining the voices saying, you know, something's got to happen in Syria. But, you know, I guess the question is, will Syria go the way of Libya with insurgents taking up even more arms and maybe with an assist in the air from NATO taking down Assad? Or will it go the way of Iran, you know, where protesters are violently put down? Or is there another question?
I think history doesn't repeat itself, although it does sometimes rhyme. And I think the great danger in Syria, which is perhaps a greater danger than we had in Libya, is of a kind of outcome where you get the bad guy goes, but then you get a descent into sectarian violence. And Syria is, if anything, more combustible than Iraq was, with the Alawites, who are the religious sort of minority Muslim group that from which President Assad draws most of his support, feeling that they're under threat from the Sunni minority, and many Sunnis perhaps wanted to get revenge on them. Then Christians and Druze and others all. So there's an all-out civil war will be disastrous, which makes it all the more important to try and get a negotiated solution. But I think that the key thing is whether the Arab League and Turkey, which I think are the countries that are in a position to do something, will actually do it. And you know, the sight of Turkish planes flying overhead, I think, would be tremendously demoralising for the regime. They only really have two really effective military units. Much 100% Alawite. Other than that, their soldiers tend to defect or run away or not fight properly. So if one can apply pressure to those units and to the leadership, I think there is the chance of some give.
We're speaking to Edward Lucas at The Economist magazine. He's there in their studios in London. I just have to say there's been a slight breakup every now and then, so we apologize for that. But you were well worth listening to, despite that. And I just, before we take a break, we want to, you know, scan the international horizon with you at a time when there are several hot spots. But we're talking about Russia being in Syria today, Russia supplying Syria with some of these tanks that are now attacking homes. Just, you know, very briefly, your thoughts on that connection, the Russian-Syrian axis?
Well, Syria is a major customer for Russian weapons, and the Russian arms industry is politically quite important. And Syria is also home to Russia's only base outside the former Soviet Union, although it's a pretty pathetic base. It's a naval base for a country that effectively doesn't have a navy anymore. But I think the key thing for Russia is that they see the Arab Spring as part of a pattern in which the West topples doesn't like and installs regimes that it does. And the West, they feel the West always says this is a one-off, and it isn't. We said that Iraq was a one-off, Afghanistan was a one-off, Libya was, and now Syria. So although that's a very distorted way of viewing it, they see this as a road that would lead to regime change in Moscow, and they don't like that.
Yeah. Edward Lucas, international editor for The Economist, whose brain we like to pick about international hotspots on occasion, and now is the time to do it. Edward, we've been talking about Russia being in Syria today, Russia and Syria allies, but just before we move on to Israel, Iran, I just want to ask you, you were Moscow bureau chief for The Economist, and we saw these protests this past weekend against Vladimir Putin running for another presidential term. Where do you think that's going?
I think that the Putin regime has lost a lot of legitimacy in the last few weeks. It hasn't actually lost power, and I think one has to reckon it's pretty likely he's going to win, almost certainly on the first round, just possibly on the second round, the first round being on March the 4th. The big problem for him is what do you do after that, because what's really changed is that Putin really looks ridiculous now in the eyes of many Russians. It's quite extraordinary if you go on the internet and just go to YouTube and look for videos about Putin. There's a new, very funny, savage parody coming up almost every day. And that just didn't happen a year or so ago. He can't appear in public without being booed or whistled.
Isn't that something? I mean, how are you, you know, a longtime observer of the region, how weird is that to you?
It's very, I mean, in a way, it's very overdue that I've never, I mean, I've been a critic of Mr. Putin since he first became prime minister back in 1999. I've never liked the KGB and had plenty of experience of them during the Soviet Union. And I didn't like the idea of an ex-KGB guy running Russia. But he benefited for a long time of A, not being Yeltsin and this not being the 1990s. So he met the hunger for stability and prosperity. And he also played on anti-Westernism, from terrorism and on the idea that he was modernizing Russia. And all these big, strong points he had are falling apart now. The country hasn't modernized. The anti-Westernism has worn off. People have forgotten the 1990s. And instead, people are really fed up with corruption and incompetence and this kind of cult of personality around him. And so I think that the big question is, once he gets back into the Kremlin, what does he do then? And I think it's inconceivable he would last for another 12 years. I don't think he'd last for another 6 years. I think he'll be lucky to last for two. And the big question is really, how does he go? Will he be pushed? Will he resign? Will he be persuaded to step aside? What will happen?
Well, that seems to be the topic du jour. Let's turn to Iran. Israel sending clear messages saying it thinks that a window is closing to attack Iran's nuclear facilities because they're being moved underground. Today, an Israeli official said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet to stop this chit-chat about Iran. But the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, also said recently he believes an Israeli attack on Iran is likely in the coming months because of this closing window. So what do you make of this drumbeat about military action against Iran?
I would like to have a war on metaphors, and particularly a war on the metaphor of a window closing. And people are always saying we're at a crossroads. You know, this is, and in fact, international affairs doesn't work like that. There's always a continuum, and things may be easy at some points, harder later on. And perhaps if we'd negotiated differently or imposed different sanctions a long time ago, Iraq wouldn't have a nuclear program, it would be less far advanced. But right up to the point at which Iraq is preparing to launch a nuclear missile on Israel.
You mean Iran?
Iran, sorry, yes.
That's okay.
Iraq was the last one.
Yeah.
The whole basis of international security is about bargains and deterrence. And so if they build a missile, then they'll have to test the missile, then they'll have to test the warhead, then there's going to be, then eventually you'll have a nuclear-armed Iran. Do you go for a first strike? Do you wait till they try and attack you and then have a devastating counter-strike? There's a whole series of different calculations to make, and I think the idea simple binary decision, if we don't attack now, we can never attack, is untrue. My own feeling is that an attack isn't that likely, because I think that the Iranian facilities are sufficiently hardened and dispersed. It'd be quite hard to for an attack to be effective, and the risk of counter-strike is quite severe. I also feel that the whole idea that the ballistic missile program is the big problem is a little bit misplaced, that if you really want to deliver a nuclear warhead, you're probably better at doing it by a container ship in a harbour than you are by trying to send it by an accurate intercontinental ballistic missile. So I think to some extent this is being hyped up artificially.
Well, meanwhile, the Obama administration is freezing Iranian assets, restricting the activities of the central bank, the goal of, you know, denying Iran the right to sell its fuel. But people are saying that's hitting the Iranian middle class the hardest, and that's causing resentment against the West. And running parallel to this, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is called on the carpet today by the country's parliament, who want to ask him questions about, charges that he mismanaged the Iranian economy. So where are those two roads headed?
Well, I think the Iranian economy is very mismanaged, and there's no doubt about it. And there's a lot of resentment in Iran about the mullahs and the corruption and so on. I think one it would be a mistake to think that the Iranian opposition is dedicated to a nuclear-free Iran and following our security agenda. They're not. And to some extent, the pressure we put on Iran consolidates the leadership in its very intransigent foreign policy stance. I'm in favour of sanctions if they're very short and sharp and targeted and effective for a limited period. I think the danger is we get into a kind of Cuba-style sanctions, which is almost always what happens, where you keep on turning the sanctions up in order not to seem soft, but the result is to entrench the regime and sometimes almost to strengthen it and to allow them to tell a story of paranoia and isolation.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes yet, and then there's Egypt. You know, in fact, today a meeting between Egyptian officials and Americans over aid to Egypt broke up over the Egyptian judiciary trying these 19 Americans who worked for pro-democracy groups. Americans saying, if you do that, we're going to cut off aid. So that's a spasm there as well. Just about a minute to go, Edward Lucas. Just you sum up the foreign landscape for us. Sorry.
Gosh, well, let me try and do it in 15 seconds. I think there's problems everywhere, but the striking sort of common factor for me is the lack of leadership of the West. You know, I grew up in a world where when Western Europe and North America got together, stuff happened, and you know, the Japanese and the Australians and some other countries would tag along too. And we're now in a different world where, A, I'm not sure the West has quite got the capability that it had, but it doesn't also seem to have the willpower. And I think that's a mistake. And I wonder, in a way, what would happen if we just stood back and said to the Russians and the Brazilians and the Chinese, okay, you try fixing it. And mm-hmm. I think they'd probably be rather horrified. But I profoundly believe that across the Atlantic, with your country and the EU together, almost a billion people, with you include all the other allies and hangers-on, that's a for power in the world, and it should be used more effectively.
Edward Lucas of The Economist, his upcoming book, Deception, Spies, Lies, and How Russia Dupes the West. Edward, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Spicewood Beach, Texas, population 1,100, made news last week when it became the first community in this drought-stricken state to have to truck water into town because its well was running dry. Now Spicewood Beach is in the news again because the agency that controls the town's water was actually shipping water out of town just weeks before the crisis. Mose Bushell is with State Impact Texas. That's a reporting collaboration between KUT Austin and NPR that focuses on energy and environmental issues. And Mose, we understand the town doesn't actually own the water. The Lower Colorado River Authority does. But the LCRA was selling this water to water haulers?
That's right. It's not an uncommon practice here. What was happening is that the LCRA was selling some of the water from this well in Spicewood Beach, and it was being taken in by water haulers and brought to private communities that are off the public infrastructure, right, like subdivisions, mm-hmm. construction jobs. But it was, as you said, happening right up very close to the point where the well actually ran out.
Right. And these haulers would literally back up these big trucks to fire hydrants and fill up and drive away. And some of them told you that they weren't paying a lot for this.
No, not at all. I mean, they were apparently getting the water for about $32 per 4,000 gallons.
So it isn't as if the town was making a lot, you know, on having its controlling authority sell the water. And now they have to, you know, now they know that their wells have run dry and this water may have been going to water somebody's lawn in a subdivision. How are people responding there?
There's a lot of confusion, a lot of anger. And also, you know, the economics of it are very confusing because now they're actually getting water shipped into the town, paying an estimated about $200 for each 4,000-gallon load. So, in fact,
more.
They're paying more, yeah, than they were selling it for.
And yet we have to underscore that the Lower Colorado River Authority, again, that owns the wells in Spicewood Beach, they weren't doing anything wrong or illegal.
No, not at all. And I mean, you know, the water haulers would argue that they're providing a service. There are a lot of subdivisions, private homes that need water, and so somebody presumably has to bring it to them if they're going to be built.
Yeah, but I guess the residents might want a closer look at that math. So what happens now? And tell us what it's like in Spicewood Beach. Are they still having these big, we've seen pictures of them, these big tanker trucks come up and literally, you know, stick a hose into wells and give them water?
Yeah, they need to haul it up, and that's the way it's going to probably be until the drought ends and the well starts functioning again, or until they come up with a better, longer-term solution.
And Mose, just put this in perspective for us. We saw the trucks, you know, backing up to Spicewood Beach. They got a lot of attention. But how many other towns are in serious trouble?
So, yeah, this could actually just be the start. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has identified about 13 public water systems that could run out of water within the next 180 days. And those are just the systems that they've been notified about. There could be other systems out there that are in dire shape that we're not aware of. Clearly, if we don't get rain soon, we're going to see more and more situations like what's happened at this one community.
You write that a town serving 1,500 people, bigger than Spicewood Beach near Waco, is expected to run out on March 1st?
That's right, yeah. That's just right around the corner.
What are climatologists saying for how long this drought will go on?
To the degree to which this drought is attributable to a weather system, the La Nina system, it could be that we may begin to see some relief into next summer. Now, the thing with summers in Texas is that they are dry either way. So even if this weather system leaves us, we'll still be really short on water. Other climatologists see this as part of a longer, larger trend that could be with us for years and years to come.
And we understand that because of that, Texas lawmakers are looking into things that people might not have thought about before, like recycling wastewater, having collection systems on all government buildings, things like that.
Yeah, certainly. There's been more and more talk as this has progressed about desalination projects, as you said, recycling. Maybe the biggest shift right now is also just in the economics of it. I mean, we don't, like the rest of the country, there have been very tight budgets, and spending on conservation, spending on water planning, like a lot of other places, have been cut. Now folks are turning around and thinking that this is exactly maybe where they should be trying to spend some of the limited resources we have.
Yeah. Mose Bouchel, a reporter with State Impact Texas. That's a collaboration between KUT and NPR that focuses on energy and environmental issues. And just reminding us that this drought is still going on in Texas. Mose, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
California and New York are moving closer to signing on to a now 40-state deal that would force the five largest mortgage lenders to reduce home loans. States like Massachusetts, Nevada, and Arizona are also considering joining, but they'd have to settle ongoing claims against the banks. And some states are also holding out because they want to know how much legal immunity the deal will give these banks from any future criminal charges. The banks are Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. Let's check in with Shaila Dewan. She's covering the story for The New York Times. And Shaila, we don't know the full list of the states that have signed on, but does the deal spell out, you know, which homeowners would receive help and what kind?
Sure. The deal, if all 50 states sign on, is about $25 billion. It gets less if fewer states sign on. So if it's $25 billion, you get $17 billion that goes to reduce homeowners' debts. Most of that is for principal reduction, which means if you bought a house for $200,000, it's now worth $100,000. You owe $150,000, that's 50% more than your house is worth. They're going to write down your loan. The rest of that is to encourage the banks to improve short sales and do some of the kinds of things that they have been slow to do.
And also, wouldn't some people literally get cash, something like $2,000?
That's another piece. That's for people who have already lost their homes through foreclosures. If the loan was serviced by one of these banks, they would get a settlement of roughly $1,800 to $2,000.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for that is that there was this robo-signing in the foreclosure process. And this is, you know, we heard the stories of untrained workers signing hundreds of foreclosure documents without reading them, using fake signatures. Now, that is already illegal, but we understand this deal would also stop that. Why do you need a deal to stop something that's illegal?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that we're just not sure how much of that is still going on. So what they want to do is make sure that there will be no more questions about who has the right to foreclose on a house.
Well, as we know, yesterday, in one of the few criminal actions in the housing crisis, a Missouri grand jury handed up a forgery indictment against DocX. This is one of the largest mortgage servicers in the country. This company serviced the banks, and in so doing, did this kind of robo-signing. That's the forgery charge. So there is a criminal action there, and you know, we'll keep an eye on that. But back to the banks. We're hearing from George Gohl, who's with the National People Action. That's a collection of community housing groups. He wants states to hold out because he says $25 billion is just a drop in the bucket. But on the other hand, we were wondering, are other homeowners saying to their state officials, please sign up because I want that, you know, principal reduction?
Well, I think it's important to note that not every homeowner in a state is going to get principal reduction. You cannot do debt reduction on a loan that is backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. We know there are about 11 right. million homeowners that are underwater, and this is supposed to help at most a million of those homeowners. So it's very limited. However, what we're seeing is states pushing for the conduct that the banks are released from to be very limited also. So they want to limit the banks' amnesty, if you will, in exchange for this limited deal, which everyone acknowledges is a small piece of what's needed to help the housing market overall.
As George Gohl says, a drop in the bucket. And when you say limit the amnesty, mm-hmm. that's the sense that if things are uncovered in the future, the bank should be liable for that?
Right. I mean, it's a question of what kind of claims are the banks going to be released from. And if you talk to the states that have been the biggest critics of the deal, I think they started off with these very large blanket releases, and those states, like New York and California, have fought to get those releases narrower and narrower and narrower so that it's really a trade-off for robo-signing and other what they call servicing claims, which means the bank that is servicing the loan for the homeowner.
Well, and we understand this idea of legal immunity is particularly of concern in California. Why?
Well, several reasons. One is that the AG there, Kamala Harris, wants to be able to protect owners who were really victimized by origination claims. Origination means I gave you the loan under some kind of false pretense, or I gave you a loan I shouldn't have given you. There were predatory loans that actually the principal on them would increase over time instead of decreasing. She wants to be able to preserve her right to go after banks for those kinds of things. And secondly, they want to also be able to issue on the back end securitization claims, meaning what do the banks do when they stuck all these mortgages into securities, sliced them up, and sold them to pension funds like CalPERS, which is one of the largest pension funds in the world, I think. They want to make sure that they have the right to go in and recover money for their pension fund.
Because the pension funds had so invested, heavily invested in these securities that were made up of these sliced and diced mortgages.
That's right.
Well, and you know, we know that the Obama administration has been talking about trying to untangle the housing crisis by doing just this, by, you know, getting banks to lower the principal on mortgages that of houses that are underwater. You know, where does this fit in that? Because this is a deal that states are drawing up together. But does this imply that maybe going forward there will be more principal reductions?
Well, that is what the federal government would like to think. Sean Donovan, the Secretary of Housing for President Obama, has said that he views this as sort of a down payment on principal reduction, and that once it sort of makes that process more palatable to the banks, that they'll start doing more of it regardless of the settlement and how much it calls for.
Well, and how are the states that have their own lawsuits responding to that thinking? I mean, are they willing to take that chance? We've got Arizona, Nevada, New York, Illinois recently filed separate lawsuits related to foreclosure abuses. Massachusetts, here in Massachusetts, our Attorney General Martha Coakley was one of the first to take on the banks and file lawsuits. As we just said, they'd have to sort of wrap those up before they could join this. Are they willing to trust that this deal might lead to more principal reduction down the road?
Well, that's really not clear, and it's also not clear that that is those states' goal.
In other words, you know, as you've been saying, it sounds like some states might be more interested in resolving the securitization issues because that's where pensions are invested. Other states like Florida, which have huge foreclosure issues, might be more interested in getting the principals written down.
That's right.
Yeah. So as you said, just a million homes, a drop in the bucket, but maybe a dent.
Yeah, again, I think, you know, some economists say that what's the most significant thing in the housing market is the number of foreclosed homes that are pouring onto the market. And the more foreclosed homes you have pouring onto the market, the more it keeps prices down. So what they're saying is if you think of the housing market as a giant ship, this could be like a small course correction that if they just turn that enough, if they just reduce the number of foreclosures coming onto the market enough, they could put a floor under housing prices and that they would start to go the other way. So that's one theory.
Okay. Well, Shaila Dewan, national business reporter for The New York Times, catching us up on the national debate over signing on to a now 40-state deal that would force the five largest mortgage lenders to reduce home loans. Shaila, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to interview you about what it's like to work as a maid. I'd like to do a book of interviews about working for white families.
A scene from the blockbuster film The Help, in which a young white woman in 1960s Jackson, Mississippi, enlists African-American maids to write a book, something that could cost those women their jobs and their lives. The Help has four Oscar nominations, including one for Viola Davis, who plays Abilene, and one for Octavia Spencer, who plays Minnie. The film is based on the book by Catherine Stockett, who was inspired by the maid who helped raise her. It's been on the bestseller list since 2009. And a lot of African Americans are bothered by that. The Association of Black Women Historians says that both the book and the film distort and trivialize the experiences of black domestic workers. Then there's Porgy and Bess, which just opened on Broadway, star Audra McDonald getting raves, but my black friend Beverly refuses to see it. And then there's the TV show The Wire. Don't get our next guest started on that. Actually, do. We want to look at these three pieces through the prism of race with Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee is African American. I am white. We are going to have this conversation.
It should be a lot of fun.
Yes, it should. Because we know when the movie The Help first came out, we were asking you what you thought about it. You said, I'm not going to see it.
I had read a sample chapter of the book. And I just thought, oh, no, no, no. I am not putting myself through this. My grandmother was a maid for rich white families for 40 years. And I have really distinct memories of what that was like for my grandmother and what that was like for my family. So it was something that was that hit really close to home. And I didn't really like the portrayal of the maids in the beginning of the book. From that moment along, I just thought, what is this woman talking about?
And we should say, for people who haven't read the book or seen the movie, it purports to tell the story through the eyes and the words of these maids. And you're saying you don't trust that because it was written by a white woman. Did it also not feel true to you? Did it not ring true to you?
It did not ring true to me. I know that the author, Catherine Stockett, has been quite vocal about talking about the black maid she had and how much she loved that woman, but at the same time, how she really didn't bother to know anything about this woman. So if you didn't bother to know the black maid who you lived with and who you essentially say raised you when your parents got divorced, what makes you think you could now sit and write this book in the voice of these black maids? And of course, since it's in the South and it's the 60s, it's all the black vernacular you can possibly imagine. I mean, it made my flesh crawl.
Well, you're joined by many others. Duchess Harris, who's a professor, writes online, okay, well, maybe at least the book of the story was going to be about the maids, but it falls back into the same stereotypical, you need a white noble protagonist to pull the story along.
The book is called The Help, but it's really about the white protagonist who helps the help by writing a book about the help. Does that all make sense? You know, among the issues I had with the movie, and I'll admit, I did not read the book because after those first few chapters, I thought I'd had my fill, but I thought to criticize the movie with authority, I would actually need to see it. So I've seen it twice.
Really?
The two main black maids are played by, as you mentioned, Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, both of whom are very, very good. However, they fall into these Hollywood archetypes. Abilene, who's played by Viola Davis, is the God-fearing, church-going, saintly black woman. Minnie, on the other hand, is sassy black. Eye-rolling, attitude, the whole nine yards. She's also kind of the weird comic relief, and I'm not sure that a black maid in a movie about the trials and tribulations about a black maid should serve as a kind of comic relief. And again, this is what Hollywood does. Either you're sassy or you're saintly.
But so you had these issues with The Help. Others have had them with the classic opera Porgy and Bess. It was written by George and Ira Gershwin with DuBose Hayward, all white. It was revamped at the ART here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll link you to our story at hereandnow.org. And just opened on Broadway. Audra McDonald, as we said, receiving raves as Bess, the woman with a scandalous past who tries to break with her mean lover crown and take up with Porgy, the self-described cripple. Here's some of Audra McDonald's extraordinary singing from Porgy and Bess. Renee Graham, Harry Belafonte famously turned down the chance to play Porgy in a film version. And there are people like my best friend Beverly, who refused to see the show when it was here. Her family has roots in New England, and her grandmother always taught her that this was a caricature of blacks. But you had no problem with Porgy and Bess.
I had no problem with Porgy and Bess. The difference for me, say, with Porgy and Bess, although, yes, it is written by three white men, is it's the story of these black people. We're not dealing with these black characters in their relation to white people, unlike The Help. Yeah. And, you know, the issues that a lot of people have with Porgy and Bess, aside from the fact that the character Porgy spends his time on his knees because he is in the vernacular of the time, a cripple, they have a problem with Crown because he's a murderer and a thief. They have a problem with Sporting Life, who's a drug dealer and a pimp. And maybe also with Bess, who all intents and purposes may have been a prostitute and also has a drug problem. So people feel like these are sorts of stereotypes we shouldn't be dealing with. However, you can find most of those characters in The Wire, the HBO series, which many people think is the greatest series in the history of television.
Let's talk about that. This is the HBO series, The Wire. It shows the Baltimore drug scene through the eyes of law enforcement and drug dealers, created by white writer David Simon, a former crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Lots of critical acclaim. But you say what?
It does take swipes at the profound failings of law enforcement and politicians and the judicial system, you know, sustaining sort of drug-infested, poverty-stricken neighborhoods. At the same time, I could never get past the fact that the show seemed like a glorification of criminality and black-on-black violence. Now, there were good, upstanding black characters, and there were good, upstanding white characters, but what drew people to the show were the black criminals. Stringer Bell, the NBA pursuing henchman, and more than anyone else, Omar Little, the gay farmer in the Dell whistling robber and murderer.
Fans loved Omar.
Loved Omar no end. People still talk about Omar in any number of blogs. You know, I grew up around lots of Omars. I went to school with Omars. And when I became a journalist and started covering cops, I covered a lot of trials and a lot of funerals for Omars. Omars are not amusing. Omars are not charming. They're dangerous and they destroy neighborhoods. Now, David Simon and people who like the show may say, well, that's exactly how it was portrayed. But that isn't how it was portrayed. Not when you have Omar whistling the farmer in the Dell. It became this whole sort of like fun thing that Omar was going to do, and he was going to blow someone away. Didn't matter if he was blowing away another bad guy. The bottom line was that he was still destroying his neighborhood.
So that's The Wire. But Renee, to your broader point, that this isn't about whites writing about blacks. It's, you know, as in the case of The Help, whites knowing what they're talking about.
I think the first lesson of writing is you write what you know. When I was in college, I was exposed to the short stories of John Cheever. Loved them then, still do. I embarked on this long sort of ill-fated idea that I could write short stories like John Cheever. But in writing them, I was trying to write stories about rich, unhappy white people in the suburbs. What did the inner city kid from Queens, New York know about rich, unhappy white people in the suburbs? Nothing. The stories were terrible. I didn't know what I was talking about. That was the problem I had with The Help. I felt like Catherine Stockett, and by extension the filmmakers, don't really know what they're talking about.
We just want to note, too, we've talked about some cases where you didn't think it was done very well, The Help, but there are cases where you think it was.
Well, Porgy and Bess is an example I'm perfectly fine with. I also really, really enjoyed Quentin Tarantino's adaptation of what was originally Elmore Leonard's Rum Punch, which he made into Jackie Brown. And he really turned that movie inside out. You don't have all these black characters. You don't have this sort of storyline set in L.A. the way it is in this movie. And he does that, and he makes it really vital and funny and alive, and he manages not to fall on stereotypes.
Here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham, talking about lots of things here. The Help, Porgy and Bess, The Wire, through her unique prism. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
I was the third brother of five.